Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning and welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, new records show just how bad the Phoenix Open could have gotten when raucous crowds got out of control.
And what Arizona's water policy says about how the rest of the country may be able to deal with other difficult issues.
But first, House and Senate Appropriations Committees today are scheduled to begin debating and voting on the package of bills that makes up the budget for the new fiscal year. The plan aims to close a roughly $1.4 billion shortfall for the rest of this fiscal year and the next one. The current fiscal year, by the way, ends at the end of the month. The budget would make cuts across state government as well as sweep money out of dedicated funds into the general fund to help close the gap. KJZZ's Cameron Sanchez from the Politics Desk is here now to talk about what's in the budget and what its future may be in the legislature. Hey there, Cameron.
Hello.
Happy day. It's budget time.
Yeah.
So what is in this budget? What are some of the highlights?
Well, there's a lot. So basically, the state has to address this deficit of like $1.4 billion. So all of the budget talks have been around how to account for that. And it looks like the main way we're going to do it is to cut, or at least, you know, cut for now, several projects that were approved last year, things like transportation projects, and for the State Water Infrastructure Finance Authority, known as WIFA. So those are the deepest cuts. And then we're going to also be looking at cutting agencies' operating budgets by about 3.5% across the board, although some agencies are exempted from that.
Yeah, those are like the Department of Corrections and the Department of Child Safety. Those are some of those that are exempt from those cuts?
Yeah, and public safety.
Public safety. So when you talk about WIFA, the Water Infrastructure Finance Authority, if I'm getting that correct, that was the agency that was supposed to get a lot of money, for example, to look into a desalination plant. It seems like that's not happening now.
Right. So a couple of years ago, in Governor Doug Ducey's last year, that was a really big push. And that was sort of the focal point of the budget talks at the state legislature, was getting all that money into WIFA, $1 billion over the course of 3 years. And then last year, they chopped some of that down, and this year it's even more of a reversal. So unfortunately for WIFA, they're operating with a much smaller budget than they expected to be. And it's kind of the general consensus between lawmakers that what they have now is not enough to do a big project like desal.
So basically just do some small stuff for now, and then maybe they'll get some more money later on? Maybe?
Yeah, I don't think that any of these cuts are necessarily permanent. It's just a matter of balancing the budget this year, and if and when they have more funds in the future, they'll turn back to these projects.
Now, are they confident, Republican leadership and the governor, that these cuts are sufficient to get them where they need to be to balance the budget?
I think the cuts are sufficient. I think everyone agrees on that point. I think it's still not clear if they have the votes if they were to put the budget up right now, but they're not intending to put the budget up today, as far as anyone knows. They have to go through a certain process. So the budget bills have to go through a committee, and that's happening today. But they could also not vote on it until next week.
So what are some of the concerns that you're hearing from lawmakers on both sides? Because, right, this by definition, has to be, at least in some ways, a bipartisan budget.
It does, yeah. And, you know, making cuts is painful. So no one's really 100% happy, I would say, in the spirit of compromise. A lot of those projects that are being cut are projects that lawmakers approved of last year, sort of got them on board with last year's budget. And so now they're getting those things taken away from them. So that's not something that they love. I think I've heard some concerns about the education portion of the budget in particular. So there are a lot of changes in the education section. The universities, for example, are going to be taking some of those agency cuts. But in K-12, actually, there are some changes to our voucher program known as the ESA program. There's one cut that I think Democrats see as somewhat marginal, but it's to prevent double dipping. Like if a student is in a public school, then they go to ESA-funded summer school or something, and they go back to public school, that they could be, you know, the state could be paying for more than the value of a normal student. So that's trying to prevent that. And then a few other little things like fingerprinting employees, which the Democrats support, but they want the ESA program to be, you know, all but abolished. So those little changes are not satisfactory. And then there's this thing about poverty weights. So schools basically get more money if they have a lot of low-income students to sort of help them out. There's a proposal to eliminate that, which people are a little suspicious of.
On the ESA front, I mean, you and Wayne Chesky were reporting earlier this week that Governor Hobbs sort of teasing that there are going to be guardrails, I think, is the word that she used. She, of course, has called for capping the universal voucher program and maybe requiring students to spend a certain amount of time in public school before getting an ESA if they go somewhere else. Doesn't seem like any of that's in there.
No, it does not. And so, you know, you could call it a guardrail, I suppose, but it's not a huge guardrail. It's a very low guardrail.
So are you hearing bipartisan concerns? I mean, besides the usual, hey, this was a transportation project in my district that I really fought for and I'm kind of bummed it's not there. But in terms of like agency cuts and some of the other, maybe some of the other ESA stuff, are you hearing concerns from both sides of the aisle on this?
I am hearing concerns from both sides of the aisle. But, you know, if they don't come up with a budget in the next, you know, week and a half or so, then the government shuts down. So it's really in everyone's best interest to get something out there. And I think ultimately, you know, they're closer than ever.
And do you think that it is safe to say, not asking you to look in a crystal ball here, the bills that are coming up today in the, I think the House Appropriations Committee is coming up in about an hour and a quarter, in the Senate a little bit later today, the bills that are being, that were introduced, those probably not going to be the bills that are final voted on and become the actual budget. There'll be changes between now and then?
There's almost always a tweak and a half, you know. I would expect strongly that there are some changes, yes.
Okay. That is KJZZ's Cameron Sanchez from the Politics Desk. Thanks, Cameron.
Thank you.
It may be scorching outside now, but let's go back a few months to February when it was cold out and rain poured down on the annual Waste Management Phoenix Open. The tournament, often called the People's Open, has long been known as a raucous party of a golf tournament. But this year's event went much farther. Drunken fans, unruly spectators, arrests, and overwhelming crowds marred the annual event. And now internal emails obtained by the Arizona Republic show things were even worse than previously known, and fans were in more danger. Sam Kamak is covering the story for The Republic and joins us now. Good morning, Sam.
Good morning.
All right, so take us back to this tournament and just what went wrong. I remember the headlines. I remember talking about it on the show. It was a big deal sort of in and out of the sports world, right?
Yeah, definitely. And it made national headlines. So the tournament runs pretty much all week from Monday to Sunday. Things kind of started to get a little bit out of control earlier on in the week. Not too bad, some arrests. But around Friday and Saturday, the weather was horrible. It was rainy, cold, and things just got really kind of you use the word ruckus. I think that's a good word. It was it was chaotic. People were, the crowds were massive. People were, you know, super drunk, yelling and screaming at the golfers. And eventually on Saturday, the tournament had to stop admitting people. So there were a lot of fans who were upset, longtime fans who couldn't get in. And then also some golfers who were pretty open about, you know, their annoyance and saying whether or not they weren't sure whether they were going to come back.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so it was not good at the time, but you got internal emails and police reports from the Scottsdale Police Department about this incident, a lot of them, and they show that things were, it sounds like, even worse than we knew. Tell us what you found here.
Yeah, so absolutely. So, the initial impression was that it was kind of just a out of control sort of party atmosphere, which ultimately that was what it ended up being. But behind the scenes, things were, the police chief had written in an email, things were close to disaster, just absolute collapse because of the size of the crowds and kind of the crowd density in certain areas. So what the record showed was a lot of stuff. It kind of fleshed out what exactly happened behind the scenes and how concerned police were. They had to take a lot of these, they described it as unprecedented steps, like cutting holes in fences to try and alleviate like congestion in certain areas of the course so people could get out. They had these, I forget the exact word, but sort of like floodgates, these big, you know, emergency gates that they can open up if things get too crowded. They had to open up all those, shut down roads. So if they hadn't done that, what they said is that it could have been a crowd crush event, which is, I mean, that's kind of what it sounded like, people kind of getting trampled and getting seriously hurt.
Wow. Okay. So big consequences could have been. You wrote there also were a record number of arrests at the tournament this year. How many did it add up to?
Yeah, so the nightly reports from Monday to Saturday show 85 people arrested. And then there were at least 54 of those that, you know, they ended up actually getting charged. We're still trying to get a little bit of clarity on those numbers. The PD just got back to us with some of the nuances of those yesterday. But overall, the figures that we have, they suggest that the total number of arrests had surpassed the 2023 event, the entire 2023 event this year on Thursday. It had already gone past that. Wow. And, you know, by Tuesday, already passed what had the number of arrests on 2022. So things really had started to get bad earlier on in the week, even before the crazy weekend.
Yeah. There was also a woman who fell two stories right at the 16th hole. Some arrests made some officers attacked, like some notable incidents here.
Yeah, absolutely. So the woman, the 16th hole where she was sat has kind of a guardrail in the back. And after that, it's just a two-story drop straight down. And what I could glean from the records is she was sitting up on that railing with her feet on the bleachers rather than sitting on the bleachers and fell backwards and literally broke her face. She ended up, it wasn't life-threatening, but she had to go to the hospital with shattered face bones. And then that happened on Friday. And there was also a aggravated assault on a police officer that took place on Friday.
Yeah. Talk more, Sam, about the crowd management strategies that officers had to use to avert this kind of disaster they're talking about. You mentioned sort of cutting holes in fences so people could get out, cutting off alcohol sales. What else happened here?
Yeah, well, they at one point there was a bottleneck of people kind of just jammed up at the front gate. So they stopped scanning tickets for a period of time. Later on, they ended up just completely cutting off entrance to the course. And like you said, they cut off alcohol around 2 p.m. But they also kind of the things that were less obvious, they shut down roads around the event. They prevented buses. A lot of times people use shuttles or buses to get in and out of the event. They stopped allowing buses to bring people in. It was really, they kind of had to think on their feet. And that's, again, what the chief said in that internal email, that without those steps having been taken as quickly as they were, things could have gotten far worse than just a drunken kind of obnoxious party atmosphere that it was.
How much did the rain have to do with this? And why did that affect things? It closed down certain parts of the course that were less, there was less space for fans to be in, essentially?
Yeah, so I mean, it didn't make sense initially. I mean, it didn't make too much sense when some of the event runners were blaming the weather. It was, you know, there were big questions about, okay, why does that have to do with what ended up happening? But the PD kind of cleared that up. And essentially what happened is the golf course is huge. And so normally there's a lot of space for people to spread out, but a lot of it's grass too. And so because it had been raining all week, it was just muddy and slippery and people were avoiding those, you know, avoiding the grass pretty much. So they congregated on the sidewalks and paved areas, and there just wasn't enough space to hold as many people that were there. So things just got super dense and crammed up into narrow parts of the course, and it just kind of prevented police from being able to get around as well as they could have. Obviously, when you squish a bunch of you know, drunken, frustrated fans who are waiting in 4 hour long lines together, things can spiral out of control. Yeah. And that's what happened.
Sam, what did the Thunderbirds have to say about this? They run this event every year. It's a long running event, right? What's their response?
Well, so they haven't given us anything specific about what they're changing yet. They did tell us early on that this was going to be a turning point, and that there was nothing off the table in terms of changes that they were going to make. So again, we don't know specifics on that yet. My understanding is that they're going to put together an event plan for next year by sometime this fall. So we'll probably have a better idea then. And then the PD, they also kind of take part in that and do their own process. They said it's a year-long process for them. So we could see what changes they suggest at some point. If I had to guess, I'd say early next year, right before the next tournament.
Yeah. All right. We will leave it there for now. More to watch for. That is Sam Kamak covering the story for the Arizona Republic. Sam, thanks for coming on. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Good morning. It is the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, a conversation with the lead singer of Old Crow Medicine Show.
And now let's head to Tempe, to Apache Boulevard, a little ways east of ASU's campus, along the light rail line, where one of many apartment complexes is being built in the valley. But this one is a little different.
This is Cul-de-sac Tempe, and right now we're on the Paseo. Instead of a road full of traffic, this is only used by fire trucks and food trucks.
That's Ryan Johnson, the CEO and co-founder of Cul-de-sac Tempe. They build themselves as the first car-free community built from scratch in the country. That's right. I said car-free in the Phoenix metro area, one of the most car-dependent major cities in the country. But Johnson isn't deterred.
So this place is built for people. Most projects are built starting with thinking about how it's going to be parked, and cars dictate the design. And instead, we focus on people.
They're in phase one of building and opening the 17-acre community now, with about 180 residents living there as of May 1st. By phase three, they hope to have 1,000 people living here, Johnson told me.
So the idea here, we tongue-in-cheek call it Mykonos-inspired desert modern.
Here's the rub. If you live here, you can't own a car. Or at least you can't park it here. Johnson himself says he hasn't owned a car in 14 years. Instead, you'll get discounts to on-site rideshare services, light rail passes, and a free e-bike to the first 200 people who move in. But they're still in the middle of a not very walkable city, and temperatures are reaching the 110s. So I asked Johnson more about it all as he showed me around earlier this spring.
You don't get the heat island effect. So this apartment complex actually feels 15 degrees cooler than the apartment complex next door. And that's because there's not a drop of asphalt. There's narrow corridors that create lots of shade. And then the white buildings reflect heat.
So that was because we're in a really hot place, I'm sure, but also just for walkability. Because you wonder this when you hear about a car-free community in Phoenix. What happens in the summer when it's 115, right?
Yeah, and the image people have from the heat is it's actually getting from the grocery store into their car with the greenhouse gas effect, and they might burn themselves on the seatbelt. That's actually not 110, that's 175. And when you're using this portfolio of transportation options and you live in a place that doesn't have as much of the heat island effect, in many ways, it's better this way.
Let's keep walking. Yeah, it feels very windy. People get lost when they first move in.
Yeah, it's like a bit like a casino in that way. But eventually, it's clear where everything is. And then it starts to have lots of interesting nooks and crannies. There's Prospect and Refuge. So right here, you can see that down this path, there's a winding corner where it's interesting. You look down there and say, oh, I wonder what's down there.
Yeah.
And the spoiler is that the pool's down there.
So I wonder, the interesting thing about that, right, is like, can you build it from scratch? Like when we talk about traditionally a walkable neighborhood, it's like taking a city that's been there a long time and making it more walkable, especially if we're talking about it in Phoenix, right? But how did you go about sort of trying to build it from the ground up and manufacture it in that way?
So we wanted to go to a location that had the right kind of job growth to support additional population and also find a city that welcomed growth. And we worked with lots of different stakeholders to find out what was important to everyone. And we brought forth this plan that this shows that you can build walkable neighborhoods successfully in the U.S. in the 2020s. And that's part of, you know, what we're doing is you know, we have plans to grow, but also we want to show other cities and other developers that these kind of projects can thrive. And the tailwinds in terms of transportation are so strong. There's lots of mobility technologies, including simple things like the light rail, but also things like Lyft and Waymo, that still so few people have tried them. And as those trends play out over a number of years, we're going to see millions of more car-free people.
So you feel like you're sort of on the beginning of this trend. Like Phoenix and Tempe, I mean, the Valley is such a car-driven and car-centric kind of place and culture. I wonder about trying to find the people who are interested in that. Do you think that this is just underestimated? Many people are ready for this?
Yeah, it's substantially underestimated. There's so much demand for this, especially once people experience it. Over half the U.S. wants to live in a neighborhood like this, including 92% of Gen Z. And so we need to build millions of more units like this.
I want to back up and talk a little bit about you, where you're from, how you kind of came up with this idea, like to be the first, you know, car-free community, and to put it in a place that is so car-centric like this is a really interesting idea, and it's gotten a ton of press and a lot of attention. Tell me about you and where this idea came from.
Yeah, so I grew up in Phoenix, and for college, I turned down MIT to take the Flynn Scholarship, and that's something for 20 students a year in Arizona, and went to U of A, and a couple things happened from that scholarship. One is that they sent the class abroad, and I saw great cities like Budapest and Tokyo and Amsterdam and said, wow, there's lots of great ways to make cities. And also I used the scholarship money to get into real estate, built a portfolio of 60 bedrooms, just learning how to renovate, property manage, etc. when I became passionate about cities, my career was in transportation with trains and helicopters and buses, including working for the New York City subway. Then I joined as part of the founding team at Open Door. But it comes back to cul-de-sac because while that business was growing, all of the transportation technologies were moving quickly, where Lyft and Waymo and electric bikes were all progressing. And what we saw at Open Door was enormous demand for walkable neighborhoods. And people didn't always ask for it by name. They would actually, the most common thing they would say is that they wanted something cute. And when you ask them what that means, it means they want to have a coffee shop, they want to know their neighbors, have thoughtful architecture. And you look at what homes people want to buy, a lot of the homes that were built before cars in these kind of neighborhoods did so well, we just weren't building them. And we realized that new designs that use these new transportation technologies was how we were going to bring walkable neighborhoods back. And that was the genesis for cul-de-sac.
So it was a homecoming for you in the end. So I want to talk a little bit about, yeah, choosing to do it here, right? Like, there are obviously, like, economic reasons to doing it here. But I wonder, even more specifically, like, why this plot of land? Why this part of the city? I mean, there's not, like, a ton of walkable stuff around here, right? Like, you see, like, a lot of open space and brand new buildings building up here as well as cul-de-sac. Are you hoping that you can create everything people need just right here?
So we found this parcel. It's 17 acres and right on the light rail. It's actually really hard to get something that's that good. And we knew with that kind of scale, we could add a lot of amenities. And we've actually catalyzed a lot of things being built around the area. One of the things we've done is we worked with the city to build a protected bike lane that's going in now. It opens later this year. And that gets to Tempe Marketplace. There's so many people that would bike if it were safer. And so we can make the connections to the rest of the neighborhood fantastic. We can also add lots of amenities here.
I wonder if you've gotten pushback. I wonder, like, what kind of critics have said, because there's been a lot of good press, but I always wonder this. When you do something on the front end of a trend, right, like, a lot of people are going to say, you're crazy. Like, you cannot create a car-free community in the center of Phoenix. What do you say?
Yeah, a lot of skeptics. A lot of people need to see it to believe it, and that's why it's so different now being open. When we started a while back, people said, wow, that's you know, it's going to be hard to get the demand. It's going to be hard to get the neighbors to love it, and now it's open. And neighbors love it. The demand has been fantastic. And people say, actually, this is the future.
So say I have a car, but I want to live in a place like this. What do you do?
So if you want to have a car, there's plenty of other places. There's lots of great neighborhoods in Arizona. So the key thing here is that you can't park on site. And so if you wanted to have a car, you'd have to park elsewhere. But you really would want to live somewhere else if that's what you wanted to do.
Is that in the requirements when you see, you said, like, you have, you know, a basic, like, leasing application? You say, do you have a car? Sorry, you can't live here?
We can't prevent somebody from owning a car, but it says that you can't park it on site or in the immediate surrounding area.
Do you hear kind of concerns from folks who are trying to move here when that happens? Like, what do they say?
Well, for a lot of folks, that they aren't quite ready for that. What we hear a lot is that people are interested in learning more about that lifestyle. I mean, it's a big change. I mean, patterns take years to evolve. I had an SUV in college, and understanding what it takes to be a power user of mobility and logistics technologies, once people experience it and they know other people that are living like that, then they see how wonderful it is. So initially, a lot of people start with a lot of curiosity, and then once they learn more, we see a lot of people that are ready to take the plunge.
Okay, but I'm sure you also have people who live here who just kind of park on the street next door and walk over and still live here, right?
So the vast majority don't have a car.
So the last kind of thing I want to ask is a little bit about, I guess, the kind of mind shift, right? Like, there's a lot of theory behind creating something like this. You're reminding me of conversations I've had with people who are kind of at the forefront of, you know, self-driving car technology, which lots of people will still say, that's crazy, I'm never going to do that. But it's, I wonder how you think about getting people to change their mindset and how quickly you think that'll happen in a community like this.
Yeah, a lot of these trends are working in parallel. If you just think about the broader country, so still less than half of people have tried Lyft or Uber. And the next generation, we're fortunate in Phoenix to be the launch place for Waymo, and that's going to create millions of more car-free people. Also, electric bikes, it's not just a little bit different from a bike. It's a completely different transportation mode. And also, it's not always a sacrifice. When somebody wants to do a weekend trip in Sedona, we have car rental on site, rentable by the hour. It's a little bit of a shift from just having a car parked everywhere, but it also comes with freedom.
All right. Well, thank you so much for sitting down with me and answering every question I can think of about this. Thank you very much.
All right. Yeah, thanks for coming.
That was my conversation with cul-de-sac CEO and co-founder Ryan Johnson. You can see photos of our walk through the development on our website. That is theshow.kjzz.org.
What can Phoenix and Arizona tell us about the future of the country? That's one of the questions my next guest tried to answer in a new piece in the Atlantic magazine. Staff writer George Packer says his editor-in-chief told him a couple of years ago that he wanted Packer to write a really long story about some place in the U.S. that could tell us whether America is viable. A vague and ambitious project, Packer says. His editor then suggested Phoenix, since it has so much of what is both difficult and possible about the country. Over the past 9 months, Packer visited several times, speaking to politicians, farmers, policy experts, immigrant families, and activists, both on the left and right, among other people. The result is one of the longest pieces the magazine has published in decades, called The Valley. I spoke with Packer earlier about his reporting here and asked, when he looks at a place and tries to determine whether or not that place can tell us about the future, what he found in that regard during his trips here.
I mean, I really started cold, although hot, because it was summer, in the sense that I didn't really know anyone. I didn't know much about Phoenix. I just started trying to make contacts and talk to people, and very soon realized that what interested me most was the nexus of two things, one of them being climate, which includes heat and water, and the other being politics, especially political extremism, which is something that afflicts the country and afflicts, I think, Arizona and Metro Phoenix particularly. And whether something as big and complicated and basic as water and the threat to water in Arizona and around Phoenix could be solved by a political culture that's as divided as ours and as sort of hot and intense as ours gets.
One of the things I found really interesting in reading this was that you talked about a lot of the issues that a lot of folks have talked about in Phoenix in terms of heat, in terms of, politics and, it's becoming more of a swing state, some of the extremism here, homelessness as an issue, that kind of thing. But as you referenced, you really took the issue of water and made it sort of a through line here. And I'm curious, what did you learn? What did it tell you, not just about water and whether that is an issue that can be solved, but maybe on a broader scale of whether any issues can be solved given the current political climate here and across the country?
Oh, there was so much to learn. I mean, I sat down with Sarah Porter of Arizona State's Kyle Center for water policy. And the first thing she said to me was, probably most of what you think about water here is not true. Hmm. And she was right. Because for one thing, as you know, Phoenix itself, the city, is not short of water. So one thing you have to get your head around is that here in the desert, with a once a millennium drought, there is not an immediate threat to water supply in the metro area. But once you get beyond the municipal water systems into the exurbs and the new developments, suddenly water is urgent and threatened because they are depending on groundwater or on water that has to be brought in from pretty far away through infrastructure that may or may not exist. And the scale of growth is far ahead of the pace of finding water. So I soon learned that even though there are parts of Phoenix and Arizona that have planned well for the desert, for water, there are parts where growth is threatening it. And that also includes the rural hinterlands. I went to Cochise County and talked to people whose wells had gone dry because of groundwater pumping by mega farms. So to answer the second question you asked, what I learned was water sort of escapes the narrow confines of the red-blue divide and the culture wars, at least so far. It is not a culture war issue in Arizona. It's a local issue. And it's so basic that it allows people to stop thinking in the static terms of our national politics and instead to think about what will work for this community or for this family or for this county. And that to me is a little glimmer of hope because it is, although it's whiskey's for drinking, water's for fighting, I must have heard that 50 times. Nonetheless, the fighting over water feels in some way more sane than the fighting over immigration, for example, or education.
Well, and, you know, as you report, you know, there are both activists and policymakers and politicians on, especially on the water issue, whose frame of reference is, as you say, their neighbor's wells have run dry or their wells have run dry. And it's a really, not only is it a local issue, it's a very personal issue for a lot of them. I wonder if that maybe serves as a template for other, maybe even more controversial, tricky issues to solve in terms of putting a human face on an issue or making it not about sort of the universe of this issue, but let's deal with what's going on this block or in this community.
I think that's exactly right. For example, in Cochise County, as you know, it's one of the most conservative counties in Arizona. Mm-hmm. It went heavily for Trump, and it's also a place that is among the most threatened by loss of groundwater. I talked to farmers in Cochise County, religious conservatives who would not have a whole lot in common with a Democratic Party activist from Phoenix, but who understood that if they want their farm to be there for their children and for their grandchildren, they have to start conserving water. And it's not just about this or that individual putting in place a conservation plan. It has to be done to some extent collectively because it affects the whole county. It affects the whole basin. The Wilcox Basin is where I spent time. Mm-hmm. Which means there may need to be regulation from the state, which is not something conservatives generally favor. But if your well is dry, or if your neighbor's well is dry, or if your farm is not going to be able to sustain its production over the next decade, then you start thinking about other things. And it has this way of cutting through disinformation and cutting through partisan cliches and focusing the mind on something about as real as it gets, which is water. And that's why I do think it has it's a kind of example of how we could think in a different way about issues that affect us very personally, as you say, very locally, but are also universal. And therefore, the solutions have to involve all of us. They can't simply be my tribe against your tribe and I win and you lose.
At the risk of being a downer, though, despite all of that, water is still a plenty controversial issue in this state. And, you know, as I'm sure you heard and learned during your reporting trips, you know, getting policy done on it is increasingly difficult, it seems. And you know, maybe not on the partisan lines that we're used to, but still, you know, very distinctive policy lines. And it's still, as I said, very difficult to get, you know, big policy done here.
That's absolutely right. I mean, when you think about why Phoenix has water, it's because of three 20th century bipartisan policies. The Salt River Project dams of the early 20th century, the Central Arizona Project, which was signed into law in the 60s with the backing of Democrats and Republicans, including Barry Goldwater, mm-hmm. and the 1980 Groundwater Management Act, which was a Democratic Governor Bruce Babbitt and a Republican legislature. There isn't that kind of cooperation anymore. So in Arizona, partisanship has taken over water policy and has cut a whole bunch of loopholes into the Groundwater Management Act and stopped the ability of the legislature and the state government to conserve and to create new rules so that groundwater isn't depleted. And at the same time, there's a once a millennium drought going on, which some people may not admit is going on. So those two things have prevented water policy from adapting to the 21st century in the Phoenix area. But if your well goes dry and your state representative says, we're not going to regulate because regulation's bad, you may have voted for him or her time after time, but suddenly they don't seem like they're representing you. They may have lost touch with you. And that's why I do think personal experience, the direct physical experience of losing water, can begin to push elected officials and policymakers into a more sane direction if they listen to the people who they represent.
That is George Packer, staff writer at The Atlantic magazine. His latest piece is called The Valley. More of our conversation in just a moment.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Let's return now to my conversation with George Packer, staff writer at The Atlantic magazine, about his piece called The Valley. It's a long story, one of the longest the magazine has published in decades, and tries to answer some big questions, both about Phoenix and Arizona, but also the rest of the country. Before the break, we spoke about water and efforts to solve problems related to it. And I asked if Packer got the sense that what he found about water could apply to other issues that are affecting people here in the Valley, be it housing and homelessness or immigration and border security, and if it could help impact policy on issues affecting other communities across the country.
I mean, that's asking a lot, and I don't have any wisdom about the direction those issues are going in, except that they just seem to become more divisive and polarized every year. Certainly immigration has never been more of a hot button and sort of third rail issue that a lot of politicians don't dare touch and other politicians just use as a wedge issue. I think Democrats are beginning to realize they've lost that argument over the border and have to figure out a way to win back the trust of the voters on it. Abortion may be the same going the other way for Republicans who've lost the trust of voters on it. Those issues are so, in some ways, insoluble, or at least have not been solved for so long, and there may be no middle ground, especially on abortion, that I don't think water is really the model that they're going to follow. What struck me over and over was how everyone I talked to at the ground level, ordinary people, were tired of the extremism, tired of the polarizing rhetoric, kept saying, why can't we just acknowledge we're all together in this and solve problems? But once it gets to the level of the airwaves or of national politics, that's lost and they have to choose sides. And that, I don't know the answer to that, but let's just say I felt more hopeful when I was talking to a tire store manager or a widower in Mesa or a family in Maryvale than I did when I was at, say, the Turning Point USA convention last December in the convention center.
So when you think about the people with whom you spoke and what you learned during your visits here, and then you think about maybe what the Phoenix area can tell us about the future, like what comes to mind for you?
I think the first thing is the danger that this could easily all go wrong. I mean, one of the main figures in my piece is Rusty Bowers, mm-hmm. former Speaker of the House of Arizona, who pretty much alone among leading Republicans stood in the way of Donald Trump and Rudy Giuliani attempting to overturn the election results. There were others as well, but he was the main figure because Trump was talking to him directly and Giuliani was too. He's out of politics. His career has been destroyed. The Republican Party doesn't have room for people who have a principled attachment to democracy. And if one person was required to stand in the way and he's not there anymore, how do we know that this time around there isn't going to be outright theft or the demand for an overturning of results that will lead to violence? And violence is the thing I worry about most. And it's, to me, amazing that there hasn't been more political violence in this country over the last few years. And I really do worry that it could come, and it could come in Phoenix. It's a lot of guns. It's a lot of extreme rhetoric. A lot of people who can be whipped up into a state of anger if they feel that their vote has been stolen from them. And maybe a lack of, I don't know, a sense of belonging to each other that comes from being a big place where a lot of people come from somewhere else and are new there and don't have deep roots. And that combination, that's my biggest worry looking ahead to the end of the year.
It's interesting how, based on your reporting here, you have both reasons for optimism and reasons for pessimism, which I guess is part of life.
And part of America. I mean, we haven't talked too much about the reasons for optimism in Phoenix, but they're all around. I mean, growth and development and tech companies coming in, Taiwan Semiconductor, Intel, battery plants. I know it's not wonderful to be a resident and to see more people wanting to live there, but the fact that they want to live there is a good sign. Arizona State is, for me, a hopeful institution. It's educating large numbers of people who who otherwise might not be able to go to college and who will then become part of that tech economy of the Valley. There are good things going on. And that's one reason why I wanted to focus on Phoenix, because America still has that energy and dynamism that you just see everywhere in the Valley. But it also has this potential to go flying apart, that the social bonds are so frayed that it just doesn't take much to set people against each other.
Yeah, that is interesting. All right. That is George Packer, staff writer at The Atlantic Magazine. His latest piece is called The Valley. George, thank you so much for the conversation. I really appreciate it.
I enjoyed it a lot.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And along with Sam Dingman, I'm Mark Brody.
So, Mark, I have a hypothetical for you.
Okay.
Let's say you're sitting around a campfire, somebody busts out a guitar. What is one of the first songs that gets played?
Whew, boy. Probably either Blown in the Wind or, I guess, traditionally, Kumbaya, right?
For sure. But I would argue that somewhere in that top five is the song Wagon Wheel.
Okay.
You know, rock me, mama, like a wagon wheel. Rock me, mama, any way you feel.
Yeah, I mean, that's a pretty standard one, too, I suppose.
Exactly. And it's a song that I think a lot of people know as a hit single by Darius Rucker, but it was originally recorded by a band called Old Crow Medicine Show 20 years ago.
Hmm.
Old Crow is actually coming to Scottsdale Performing Arts Center this weekend, and I got to talk to the band's co-founder and lead singer, Ketch Secor.
Is he tired of playing that song?
You would think.
Yeah.
But it's actually the opposite.
Huh.
He told me that he sees playing the song as part of the band's mission. And he also told me that he has had music in his bones since he was a little kid.
There's a story in my family that goes, when I was a kid, I lived in New Orleans. I learned to walk and talk in New Orleans. My dad left me out in front of a liquor store so that he could go in and make a purchase. That doesn't just sound like child rearing in the 1980s. And so he's like, wait here, son. And I had seen people in the French Quarter dancing for change. And I started dancing. And when he came back out of the liquor store, I had a pile of money in front of me.
Well, there's an early signal that music can be a viable career, right?
Yeah.
You also said once, when you drag a bow across four strings, it's like a bodily smile. When do you remember having that feeling for the first time?
I can't think of the first time I felt it, but the reason I started playing the fiddle, though, is because so much of the music that makes, you know, all genres in America is dance music. Wanting there to be a reason for people to get together through music.
Yeah.
And dancing is the next best thing to sex, which is the essential act. I think it's really about, you know, it's kind of snake charm in here.
Uh-huh.
You're just trying to get dance partners together so you can, you know, keep the species going. You know, that you think of the parentage in this dance. It's a dance between largely the founders of America who come from Europe and then the founders of America who come from Africa. These two founders who are not allowed to dance together in the United States, you know, really up until, you know, present day, 50 years ago or something, this taboo dance of black and white on these shores. And the thing about the fiddle is that the fiddle is the melody and the banjo, it's the drum from West Africa. So, you know, the fiddle meets the banjo that happens here in North America. And then we're all the great, great grandkids running around.
Wow. You know, Ketch, I don't think I've ever heard anybody talk about folk music as subversively as the way that you just did.
It's the most subversive form out there.
Hmm.
I mean, it's talk about some rabble-rousing politic and stuff here, man.
Yeah.
Like, you could go to – this stuff would get you hung.
So you told Rolling Stone once, you said, I remember when I was a kid thinking I was born too late for the party, that all the cool stuff had happened. Can you tell me a little bit about that feeling? What was the party? What was the cool stuff you felt like you were born too late for?
Oh, the March on Washington in 1963 and the Bob Dylan singing The Times They Are a-Changin', and Martin Luther King linking arms with Julian Bond, and, you know, when music was on the front lines of change and advocacy. One of the things that's really changed is that the power of song has been crazily diluted. You know, it barely has, you know, the cultural fluency that it once had, and it, you know, it's just a lot less impactful.
Kind of in that vein, I wanted to ask, have you ever spent any time reading the YouTube comments on Wagon Wheel?
No, I never have. Are they any good? Are they interesting?
They're deeply, deeply reverent, and there's just comment after comment after comment of people saying Wagon Wheel was the favorite song of somebody they loved who died, and periodically they get together with their friends and they play it, and it feels like that person is there again. It seems like people come to this song to ask it to hold massive, massive feelings of longing and regret. I wonder what you make of that.
I feel really humbled by it and honored that I could have contributed something to the world that could, you know, carry away somebody's grief and or be a you know, a long distance phone call to the beyond. Country music is a unique body, and when I'm up there on the stage singing country music with my fiddle under my chin, I look out there in my audience and I see people who have vehement disagreement with one another, and yet they both bought a ticket to this show.
Right.
And so I know what it looks like, what civility looks like, because I see it every night. It's hands waving together. And one of the things I think that really unites us that we often fail to see is that we all share pain. We all share in grief. You know, the people that died in the opioid crisis are the children of left and right. Mm-hmm. The people who have died in school shootings are the children of left and right.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is all very interesting to me to hear you talk about, because in 2018, you told the Providence Journal, you said there's a role for certain songs and songwriters to spin a political narrative, and generally I'm not one of them. I'm mostly here as an entertainer. Do you still feel that way, or do you feel like you're relationship to the politics that can be associated with this music has shifted?
Well, I think the only difference now is that in 2018, you know, I didn't have a smartphone. I was still on a flip phone in 2018. Uh-huh. And so I didn't have, even though the band had 500,000 Facebook followers, I didn't have any engagement with any of them. And I'd never used Instagram before, and I was still checking my email at the public library, man. Anyhow, now that I decided, well, I guess I'm not going to be a Luddite anymore, and I'm going to get out here with everybody else on their smartphones, I just find it to be kind of vapid and disappointing. As a person who just hasn't had that much experience with social media, I'm just less convinced of any one artist's real role saying, well, this is how the country should go on this topic.
Yeah.
Because social media doesn't really do much but fan the flames.
Sure. But if I'm hearing you right, it sounds like you do feel like something an artist can do is create a space. Like if we can all sing along to Wagon Wheel together, what else can we talk about?
Yeah. I don't know, man. These are really challenging times in our country to get along with each other. And when I just stay here with my instruments and songs, I feel like a tree standing by the water, like they say in the old song. You know, I feel unmovable, like it says in the Bible, I shall not be moved.
And that makes you feel hopeful.
Yeah, because, I mean, the you know, the times change, man, and the water keeps on flowing. So rock me, mama, like a wagon wheel. Rock me, mama, any way you feel.
Hey, mama, rock me. Well, Ketch Secor, co-founder and lead singer of Old Crow Medicine Show, hitting the stage here in Scottsdale. on June 13th. Thank you so much.
Y'all come on out and see us. It's a good time.
All right, that'll do it for this Thursday edition of the show. We will, of course, be back with you again tomorrow morning with much more. Lots of politics to talk about tomorrow morning on the Newscap, Mark.
Yeah, just a little bit.
Just a little. Budget's coming. All right. Don't forget to follow us on Instagram. We are at KJZZ, the show. For Mark Brody, I'm Lauren Gilger. Thanks for joining us.
That's it for this episode of The Show podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.